In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
British summertime is finally here, and we want you to make the most of it by getting to know more of the history you love with a subscription to BBC History Magazine. Subscribe this summer and get 6 issues for just £24.99. saving 30% on the shop price. Plus, when you sign up, you will also receive a book of your choice from Russia, Revolution and Civil War, 1917 to 1921, by Anthony Beaver, In Search of the Dark Ages by Michael Wood, signed edition, or In Search of Mary Seacole, The Making of a Cultural Icon by Helen Rappaport, signed edition. To take advantage of this offer and for more information, visit www.buysubscriptions.com/summerreads2022. Offer ends on the 5th of August 2022. Offer only available to UK residents. Please visit website for terms and conditions.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine and BBC History Revealed. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. Gone with the Wind is one of the most popular novels of all time. Published in 1936, the Civil War era story made its author Margaret Mitchell an instant celebrity, and it soon earned her a Pulitzer Prize, not to mention the blockbuster film adaptation of 1940. But in her new book, The Wrath to Come, Professor Sarah Churchwell re-examines Mitchell's book to explore what it can reveal about some of the most controversial elements of American history. From the myth-making that sprung up following the Civil War, to the origins of modern debates over racism and the far right in the US. Rachel Dinning spoke to Sarah to find out more.
My first question to you is, what prompted you to draw parallels between this fictional book from almost a century ago and modern America?
Well, it really all began for me in 2017 when the debates over bringing down the Confederate monuments in the U.S. really started to escalate. Of course, they've been going on for a while at that point. Anyway, but of course, 2017, after Donald Trump took office, was the summer of the outburst of the violence in Charlottesville, the Unite the Right rally over the removal of Robert E. Lee's statue. Of course, Robert E. Lee, the general who led the South in the Civil War, that was the far right rally that ended in the death of the vehicular homicide of the peaceful protester Heather Heyer, and that was the one where Donald Trump said that there were very fine people on both sides of the argument and shocked the world by calling white supremacists, outright white supremacists, right? They were shouting blood and soil Nazi slogans. They were shouting Jews will not replace us. What people are now starting to understand is part of great replacement theory. And so all of that was happening and people were trying to understand it. And I have been teaching Gone with the Wind for many years now and knew that Margaret Mitchell, one of the things that people said about those statues, of course, is that they thought that they went up in the immediate aftermath of the Civil War and people didn't realize that they were built actually as late as they were. And they were actually built in the 20th century, not in the 19th century for the most part, or in the late 19th century. And that they were erected during battles over civil rights, and that Margaret Mitchell's lifetime coincided with this. She was born in 1900, so she died in 1949. So her life really sort of hit that first half of the century. And so as people were starting to talk about that, it just made me think of Gone with the Wind as a story I know really well, and as a familiar way of giving people a shorthand for what is such a long and complicated history with many layers of myth-making in it. When you want to understand the myth-making part of the Confederacy, Gone with the Wind gives you this easy shorthand where you can go, like the world of Gone with the Wind, that thought slavery was nice and thought it was all romantic and says it was all fabulous. It was always sort of there in my head. But I originally thought that this would be a very short book that would just kind of explain the statues. And as you know from reading it, it's not a short book. It ended up being my longest book because the story is so big and complicated. And because obviously since 2017, so much more has happened, and actually Gone with the Wind kind of kept up with it. As the history kept unfolding, Gone with the Wind seemed to me had more and more to say about what was happening now, mostly in a bad way, I should say. But so that's really why.
We're going to go into some of the myth making in more detail a little bit later on. But I thought perhaps we could talk about the book when it first came out. So Gone with the Wind came out in 1936 and made Margaret Mitchell almost an instant celebrity. She earned a Pulitzer Prize. It was adapted into a film that became one of the most successful films of all time. Firstly, what is it about the story of Gone with the Wind that has made it such a success and such a phenomenon? Why is it so appealing?
I think there are kind of a couple of answers to that question. Where anything is that big and that appealing, it's probably not going to have one single core reason why that is. But for Gone with the Wind, I think there are a couple of aspects to it. One is that particularly we can separate out its popularity then from its kind of enduring popularity. It really struck a chord at the moment that it came out. It is, although it's a novel about the American Civil War and set in the 1860s, it's very much a Depression era novel. It's very much a novel that was geared to the preoccupations of Americans in particular in the middle 1930s. And so it resonated a lot with its emotional pitch and storytelling, really connected with where people were, because it's a story about survival. Scarlett O'Hara survives war. She survives hunger. She survives the loss of everything and everyone that she loves and cares about. And it's a story about resilience. It's a story about not giving up and staring down defeat. So it's really a story about survivalism and defiance. She has this really defiant spirit. So that was clearly what struck a chord with readers in the 1930s. For those who know the movie will remember that the end of the first act, right before the intermission, is Scarlett raising her fist to the sky and saying, "As God is my witness, I'll never be hungry again." And, you know, saying that to a country with 25% unemployment, where people are middle-class professionals have become homeless and we're living in shanty towns, and this all, really, really struck a chord. But of course, you don't have to be in a Great Depression for that kind of resilience to still resonate with people. And one of the things that I was interested in the course of my research to discover was the ways in which internationally it has, and over time, historically, has resonated with people in almost any conflict situation. So Vietnamese people after the Vietnam conflict talked about the ways that they connected with it. Chinese readers connected with it through memories of famine. Certainly after the Second World War, we know it was an incredibly popular novel on the French underground. It was a resistance novel. The Nazis banned it because it was a story about resisting an occupying force. And so there, it has that ongoing sense of, as I say, of defiance and surviving against all the odds and one individual surviving this cataclysm. It's also really, really important, I think, for a lot of readers that it is a woman who's doing this, that it is Scarlett O'Hara, who is really one of the great fictional characters of all time. There are lots to dislike about Scarlett, and I go into that at some length in the book. But as a character, you gotta like Scarlett. I mean, you just have to. She is tough as nails, and she takes no garbage from anybody, and she's deeply loyal. There are lots and lots of things to like about Scarlett O'Hara, and I think for a lot of women, it's very important that she's this every woman character, and that's such a rare thing, because for men to identify with female characters is that's certainly in the minority. And so, but here's Scarlett as this American every woman, and suddenly anyone can identify with this woman and her determination to survive and to keep her home together and to keep her family together. And she never gives up, right? So she wants all the wrong things, but she never gives up. So, she's totally stubborn and determined that she will have the man that she wants. So there's a lot to enjoy about Scarlett. And I think that that people still connect to her on that level, both in the novel and in the film. And then finally, with the film, it is just a triumph of classic Hollywood filmmaking. It's incredibly glamorous. The costumes are fabulous. It all looks gorgeous. And you've got with Vivien Leigh and Clark Gable, just one of the great screen pairings of all time. And Vivien Leigh gets one of the best screen performances ever in that film. Regardless of what you think about the story, her acting performance is absolutely phenomenal. So there's still a lot to like about it.
Publicity for Mitchell's novel at the time drew attention to her research, and it was portraying a historically accurate world. She even said herself, I think, that she saw it as a realistic portrayal of the Old South. I've got a quote here. She said, "The book is as true as documentation and years of research could make it." You, I think, disagree with this. So can you tell our listeners some of the ways in which Gone with the Wind is perhaps not an accurate portrayal of the Old South?
So, I mean, she certainly believed that it was accurate. So I don't think she's lying when she said that. She wasn't setting out to deceive. The problem is that the research that she did was all from the perspective of white supremacist apologists for slavery. So it was literally the slaveholders' history. The enslavers wrote the histories that justified their enslavement of Black people. And that was the research that Margaret Mitchell was relying on. So it's profoundly biased. And in many cases, it was outright untrue. It was actually disinformation. It was a propaganda campaign that white supremacists undertook after they lost the Civil War to justify their cause retrospectively. And that became known as the Lost Cause, the myth of the Lost Cause, this idea that, and it is the idea exemplified by Gone with the Wind, the idea that that the Old South was a chivalrous, genteel world, a nostalgic, gentle, glorious world that was a kind of agrarian idyll, and it was destined to blow gone with the wind, and that it was sort of modernity that pushed, you know, industrialization and the grasping commercial north that came after this lovely life in the South, and that was how they wrote their histories of the Civil War, and those developed directly out of pro-slavery propaganda before the war that insisted that slavery was a benevolent, paternalistic system that was civilizing and Christianizing savage Africans. And that was their language. I mean, that's how they would talk about it and justify it. And so this idea developed that was deeply self-satisfying to white Southerners and let them save face after losing the war, that said that their way of life was good and it was fine and the slaves were happy and everybody, you know, and that they liked being enslaved, which is insane. I mean, you just have to pause for 1 second and think about how insane that is, right? But it's one of the things I go into it at some length in the book, as you know, is because I grew up listening to this phrase too, they Gone with the Wind, and in the ways that people talked about nostalgic images of American slavery, they would use this phrase, an ideal slave plantation. And you just have to pause and think about what moral universe are you inhabiting where you can put those words together and talk about an ideal slave plantation? You know, I mean, it's an absolute oxymoron, but that is the world that they developed. And that is the world that Margaret Mitchell believed that she was accurately depicting. So what I do in the book is try to show, I mean, it goes, as I say, it goes well beyond just saying that slaves didn't like being enslaved. We can begin with that as a pretty obvious human truth that doesn't require explanation, but then to go into the details of the ways in which that the systems that the white South created have created all kinds of structural legacies that American society is still wrestling with. And it's why the problems of race in America remain so deep-seated, because we never addressed them as a society. It's a long book and I could go into great detail about all of the ways in which it's inaccurate about slavery, but we can begin with that, right? It's a book that has the worldview that says that slavery was good, that slaves liked being enslaved. It considers the freed, emancipated Black Americans after the Civil War. It calls them trashy, free-issue darkies and uses more racist language than that to describe them for exercising their freedoms. It says that the best black people were the ones who would stay with the family, and it makes a moral judgment on that, and then says that that Black people who didn't do that are worthless and deserve what happens to them, which is racial violence, which is lynching. So that's the worldview of the book and of all the characters in it. And so what I wanted to do was pause and think about some of those cliches and how they still persist and what happens when we actually dig into the documentary history and look at what really happened.
You mentioned the Lost Cause and how it established this campaign of misinformation. And you make this claim in the book that this is still present in US culture and politics today. So could you perhaps give us an example of a modern example of how the Lost Cause is still impacting the US?
Sure. I mean, the fact that some of the insurrectionists on January 6th were carrying Confederate flags is a pretty good one right there, right? So the idea that the Confederacy was something that Southerners can and should have pride in, the Confederacy is distinct from being from the South, right? I'm not saying Southerners shouldn't have regional or local pride. You know, God bless, off you go, sure. But not in the Confederacy. The Confederacy was specifically formed to defend race-based slavery, white supremacist slavery. It was created to fight for slavery, and it was created to fight for the expansion of slavery. In particular, the Confederate Constitution declared that they banned the prohibition of slavery, and they said that it would be illegal to ever outlaw slavery, and that they were enjoining its expansion across the West as settler colonialism moved westward. And so the very idea that the Confederacy is something that Southerners, that was benign, that flag can be benign, and that it's a simple regional, symbol of where you come from, is that's already a myth, right? I mean, and then you can, keep, spinning it out. So the ideas that the Civil War was fought over states' rights, a great many Americans, both from North and South now, will tell you that the war was fought over states' rights. That is absolutely disprovable. The documentation at the time makes it very clear. And they say it wasn't fought over slavery. Well, it was. It was fought over slavery. And the Confederate leaders at the time said so, right? So all you have to do is go read their speeches and read the newspapers of the time. And that's what they're saying. But now Southerners will tell you that that's not why it was fought. And it was fought over keeping a small federal government. Well, that's a fight that is still happening in the United States right now, right? So that's part of how a great many Republicans understand their political affiliation is around small government. And that part of the cultural mythologies around the ideas of federal overreach and small government come out of those ideas about the Civil War being fought over states' rights.
When we think about Margaret Mitchell, some people might say, oh, she was a product of her time. Some people would say you can justify what she wrote because she was writing with the information she had at the time and trying, as she said herself, to be as historically accurate as she could be. But were any of Mitchell's contemporaries offering an alternate view? Were there people at this time speaking differently and maybe getting more at the actual truth?
Yeah, absolutely. So we can start with even some of her contemporary novelists from the South, William Faulkner, whose own relationship to the question of race and the Civil War and historical memory is absolutely central to his whole fictional project. And he had a much more complicated view of slavery and race relations. He had a much deeper and more vexed understanding of how ugly it was. And there was a lot more truth telling in his avowedly fictional accounts about the horrors of it. He doesn't, there's just a more of an admission there. But somebody like Lillian Smith, for example, who was Mitchell's contemporary, they knew each other, they corresponded a little bit, they didn't like each other. And Lillian Smith was, she wrote a book called Strange Fruit, which of course is the famous anti-lynching anthem sung by Billie Holiday. And Lillian Smith was a white civil rights campaigner, a white Southern woman who was against miscegenation laws and was fighting for civil rights. So so there were people like that who Mitchell certainly had access to. And then the year before Gone with the Wind came out, the great Black historian W.E.B. Du Bois had just published his History of Black Reconstruction in America, which was the first great work of African-American revisionist history that said this: all of this history is white supremacist. And we actually have to look at, if we go back and look at how Black people participated in emancipation, how they participated in the Civil War, how they fought for their own enfranchisement, how they fought for their political rights, how they worked at self-government, all of the things that they did and how they participated in this process, which has been completely erased from white historiography. And he wrote that in 1935. It was published the year before Gone with the Wind. She certainly had access to it. It was not a huge, bestseller or anything, but she certainly, you know, could have read it. And there were also plenty of white historians at that time who were starting to re-examine this stuff. But one of the most egregious things that she says, which I find really kind of indefensible when people say things like, oh, you know, she was just of her time. But one of, so this woman who claims that she researched, you know, so carefully, did absolutely no research into the Ku Klux Klan whatsoever, because she said that everybody knew. So she just took that as read. She was like, well, everybody knows. I don't need to do research into that. And that should tell you right there, that's such a red flag, that therefore there was a willful blindness there. Some part of her knew that she was going to find stuff she didn't want to know. And so she didn't do any research into that at all. So, and she could have. She could have found that out. So, you know, and the news, you know, she did all of this newspaper research and she could have. And so there are lots of ways in which she could have challenged herself more. And just used a kind of novelistic imagination of the way that Faulkner did, of just imagine people in a richer and more complex way, and just ask yourself some really basic questions, like, did Black people really like being enslaved? You know, there's such a failure of moral imagination if you can't even get yourself to ask that question. So that's why I don't personally buy that she was of her time and place defense. It was 1936. So you say it was almost 100 years ago, but from my point of view, it was 75 years after the Civil War had been fought, and we'd actually lost ground by that point. So you fight a Civil War on the basis that slavery is a moral abomination, and 75 years later, you're going, it wasn't really that bad. Yeah. So it was actually morally regressive.
It was an interesting point about the Ku Klux Klan, because I think one of the examples you have in the book is she describes them as quietly hanging someone, and just that word quietly is quite powerful there.
It's really sinister, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, the Ku Klux Klan feature heavily in Gone with the Wind. Like, a number of the characters are members and
heroes
are members. And it's kind of interesting because in the film version, the director changes the name of I don't think they're named the Ku Klux Klan. It's just referred to as a social club. And the film didn't come out that long after Gone with the Wind. So there must have been an awareness that that's unsavory. That's, you know, that's extremely unsavory to have the protagonists in this.
Yeah. It was a controversy. In fact, there were two reasons why it was really controversial at the time. People need to remember that the second Klan had only just kind of started. It never really officially disbanded, but it was defunct by the mid-1930s, but it still existed. And it just was kind of, you know, defanged, right? It had lost most of its political power, which was in the ascendancy in the 1920s. And in the middle of the 20s was when it really kind of peaked, around 1924. So this is about 10 years later. But so people were still very well aware of, and Mitchell was writing Gone with the Wind while the second Klan was dominating Atlanta politics, where she lived her whole life. And so the people were well aware that it was problematic that her protagonists were these kinds of unapologetic, you know, they were leaders of the Klan. She has Ashley, who's you know, Scarlett's supposed love. He is the leader of the Atlanta Klan in the novel, and that's something that they all take pride in. And Scarlett doesn't like it, but only because she thinks they'll get in trouble with the Yankees, not because she has any moral objection to it. Scarlett has no moral objections to much of anything, which is one of the things one can like about her, actually. But so there are a couple of things to understand there. So one is that there was, at the time, they had developed this idea, and it's another myth, that the second Klan was very different from the first Klan, and that the second Klan was problematic in the 1920s, but that the first Klan, which had emerged after the Civil War, was somehow noble, and it was all sort of, it was full of people like Ashley, who were lovely and chivalrous. And the first Klan was if anything worse than the second Klan. There's nothing to choose between them morally. They were vicious. They were violent. They were horrible, murderous. They tortured people. And I, you know, the, I go into that at some length in the book. But so the, so first of all, they thought it was defensible because they said, well, these were the first Klan, but, and so that was supposed to be why it would be acceptable to have these, characters be members of the Klan. But what happened was, first of all, Black, activists, African-Americans, campaigned to stop them from glorifying the Klan in the film. The film was made 3 years after the novel came out. It was produced at the end of 1939. And so they had about three, and Selznick announced in right away that he had acquired the rights. And then he had this whole big publicity story about how he was filming it and the search for Scarlett. So people were really aware of it, and there was a lot of noise about it. And so African-Americans were campaigning very actively to say that if you make this movie romanticizing the Klan, it is going to be directly dangerous for Black Americans, and it will act as a as an advertisement, as a recruitment poster for the Klan, and you will have more Klan membership, and it might have a resurgence, and it's dangerous and irresponsible, and you can't do it. Selznick accepted that argument partly because they were so conscious of the rise of fascism. Of course, the movie comes out at the end of 1939, as I just said, after the Second World War had started. They actually wrapped filming just as the Second World War broke out. And Selznick was a first-generation son of Jewish immigrants from what is now Lithuania. And so he was acutely conscious of the rise of fascism. And he said he didn't want the film to be an advertisement for fascism. And he was worried that if they were Klansmen, they would be. So what they did was, as you say, they took the decision to just euphemize it, to call it a social club and pretend it wasn't the Klan. The problem with that is that they still, the characters still have to go on a lynching raid because the plot demands it. Is how one of the key characters dies. And so they're still going, they're still lynchers. So call them the Klan, don't call them the Klan. They're still going out and lynching people. And that's our, those are our protagonists. And we are supposed to, we're in a worldview that is supposed to be sympathetic with the people who are going on a lynching raid. So, you know, from Selznick's point of view, he was trying to do something that would, that, but that would be, he said he didn't want, Black people, the phrase he used was he didn't want them to come out on the wrong side of the ledger in the film, but he was also trying to sidestep commercial controversy, and he didn't want the film boycotted. So he was trying to sanitize it so that everything, you know, would seem acceptable. And so, you know, whether you should sanitize the brutality of history is a question that he sidestepped.
And that's a really interesting debate about sanitizing, especially with language. And I was going to ask you a question about language in particular. So I think something you return to throughout the Raticum is how language is used in a quite a violent and destructive way, whether it's by oppressing people or by obscuring truth or by omission or propaganda. What are some of the most notable examples in how language can be a tool of violence against people?
Well, the big and most obvious one is the most famous racist slur in you know, in the American vernacular, which of course is now exported around the world, the N-word. And you know, one of the things that I show in the book is the way that that in the story, in the novel in particular, it's so deeply, is so almost unconsciously associated with violence that when characters use the word, they then start fantasizing about racial violence. So Scarlett uses the word and then thinks longingly, that's the novel's word, thinks longingly about whipping Black people, right? So the word triggers these violent racist fantasies, and it triggers actual racial violence. So they go together. And where the word happens, violence, racist violence is stalking alongside of it. And so that's the most glaring one. But it is one of the things that I was really wanting to explore and to think about more is the ways in which when we talk about sanitizing history, doing violence to history, so we have these kinds of metaphors about violence that actually what you're talking about when you go and look at the documentary history is of extreme brutal violence. And I mean, so much so that I put a trigger warning at the beginning of the book, and it's something that I really want readers to understand that they're going to confront in this book, and that I decided not to euphemize because I think that even words like torture or maiming or dismemberment are themselves too kind for what we're actually talking about. And some of the brutality of the language from the primary documents, the firsthand testimony of people who experienced this violence or witnessed this violence, gives a much better idea of how vicious and how bestial it really was, and the ways in which language is used to cloak that or to as a veil to disguise, to keep ourselves from seeing that is a really important theme in the book, I think.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
So what Baldwin said was, "It is terrible to watch people cling to their captivity and insist on their own destruction. I think Black people have always felt this about America and Americans, and have always seen, spinning above the thoughtless American head, the shape of the wrath to come."
I was going to ask a question about this, because you delve quite deeply into the very brutal realities of things like lynching. Were you, whilst researching the book, were you shocked by what you found? Was it worse than you expected? Or did you think you had a good understanding of it before you started researching?
I thought I had a good understanding of it, and I was still shocked. And I thought I knew what I was going to find, and I was still shocked. There are aspects of it that are unspeakably shocking, and the first time that you encounter them, in particular, I'm thinking of some examples from what's called the first Klan report from 1871. The white supremacist violence got so bad in the immediate aftermath of the Civil War that there were congressional hearings, much like are happening right now around the January 6th insurrection. They have a similar set of hearings to try to get to the bottom of the violence that was happening. And it's the best document. It's ran to tens of thousands of pages in the end, and it was all this firsthand testimony. And it's the best documentation that we have of the racist violence that was happening at the time. And so there's all of this firsthand testimony of people just describing incidents of racial brutality that they witnessed. And I use a few from Georgia because the whole, of course, Gone with the Wind is set in Georgia. And so I kind of use that as a focus and stick to Georgia. And so I include some examples from that. And reading the first Klan report was one of the first bits, I shouldn't say bit, it's big, but the first part of the primary research that I did when I decided that I was going to do, you know, some deep dives into primary documentation. The Klan report was where I started. And it was really the first thing that I turned to was reading the Georgia testimony, and I won't say what happens in it because it's terrible, but the one that I include in the book was one of the first ones that I read. And I still remember the impact that I was unspeakably shocked. And you know, I mean, I've been doing this for a while, right? I mean, I don't think I'm naive. And as I say, I knew about lynching. I knew what I was getting, what I was talking about. And I knew, you know, in my previous book, I was writing about people being burned alive at the stake in 1915 and 1936, people being dismembered, charred remains being sold. They would sell body parts as souvenirs. I knew all of that stuff, and I was still shocked, which gives you an indication of how bad this was. Well, you know, I'm sure you know the incident that I'm referring to. And I was, it's sickening. I mean, it is absolutely sickening. And I include one photograph of a lynching victim, and I don't know if I should say this, but when we were thinking about how to use the images, when I drafted the book, I had the images accompanying the text. And so, you know, I had a capture of the image next to the story that I was telling about this man is Charlie Hale, who was lynched in 1911 outside of Atlanta. And So I ended up having to look at that photo a lot because I was drafting the book, and you get desensitized after a little while, and you know it's there and everything. But also it was sort of small because it was in the text. And then we decided that for the finished book that we would use, we would have a glossy photographic insert. And so when I just got the book like a week ago, And I opened it up and I looked at that photo, and you can see detail in the glossy, high quality reproduction of this photograph that it was like, it's like a punch in the face. And it was like being hit and said all over again. And that was just a week ago. And I knew that photo was there, and I was still shocked by it. And I found myself wondering, I mean, there is a trigger warning at the beginning of the book, but people often just pick up a book and flip through a glossy photograph, and it's sort of sitting there waiting as this kind of, and there's something kind of symbolic about that, about this this horrific history at the core of this story, and kind of at the core of American history that we simply haven't come to grips with as a society. America just doesn't tell the truth about it yet. We're just starting to. But basically, unless you're a professional historian or doing university level work in American history, certainly when I was growing up, you didn't learn this stuff. We were not taught about the history of lynching in America. I know British historians who've said to me, as I've been working on this stuff over the last 5 or 6 years, professional British academic historians have said to me, why didn't I know this? And that's partly why I wrote this book.
How should we be approaching a text like Gone with the Wind today? Because it's still enormously popular. Is it a dangerous book if we're not reading it with this wider context alongside it?
It's a good question, and it's one that I really wrestled with, because, you know, I'm a professor of literature, so I'll, you know, first and foremost, that's where I started, and I've you know, my work has increasingly moved into history, but, you know, the study of literature and fiction is at the core of everything that I do, and storytelling. And so I'm hardwired to think that fiction is a good thing, and I'm hardwired to believe that we have to fight for protecting it and for understanding all the value that it brings and the ways it enriches our society and our minds, all of that stuff. One of the things that I talk about with this book, and it's even in the subtitle, is that there are ways in which fiction can turn into lies, and it's not always. But Gone with the Wind is a fiction that turns into a lie, because it's lying about history, and it gives you the impression that it's telling you the truth about history. And it is an act of deception. It is actively deceiving the reader into thinking that things are true that were not historically true. And that is dangerous, yes. I mean, personally, I don't think that the answer to that kind of danger is censorship. I don't believe in it, and I don't think it works. And so I would rather, and it's wrong, and it goes in, you know, it's a slippery slope into all kinds of problematic places. And basically anything that Nazis did, I'm against. And that's a simple moral rule that I still can, you know, I don't have to rethink that one. So Nazis liked it. I tend to not like it. So they burn books. I don't. And I don't mean to be flippant. I mean, I kind of mean that. But we still have to wrestle with the ways in which those kinds of fictions can be, to use your word, dangerous. And so I guess I just come back to believing in education. I come back to believing that we are a curious species. We like to learn, even when that learning is difficult, and we see value in it. And my hope is that what a book like this one can do is to say, although what you're going to learn in it is going to be painful in some ways, and it's not an easy thing to read or to think about, there is a pleasure that comes the other side of that kind of knowledge, which is the pleasure of understanding an apparently chaotic situation, and the sense that, oh, okay, because when that, for me anyway, certainly on top of a chaotic situation, if I'm also confused by it, then that just adds to my anxiety about the chaos, and the confusion is also, you can't process what's happening. And so to me, if at least we can get to a point where we understand why we are where we are, even though it might be painful, and it involves confronting things about our past that we might not want to know, and about our societies, and indeed about our present day society that we might not want to know, at least we come out the other side of it understanding something. And that's what I hope that reading Gone with the Wind in a spirit of skepticism and interrogation and historical knowledge can do. But I recognize that that's a utopian wish, and that not every reader is going to do that. And so I certainly understand why some people conclude that the answer is certainly not sort of censored Gone with the Wind, but to stop, to try to take attention away from it and say, let's stop reading it. Let's stop talking about it. Let's say that it is pernicious and something that we don't want to encourage people to think about. I think that we should think about it, but ask really tough questions about it. And as I say, I recognize that not everybody's going to do that. We can try.
And then my final question to you, I wanted to ask about the title of the book. So the full title is actually The Wrath to Come, Gone with the Wind and the Lies America Tells. But I wanted to ask about that first bit, The Wrath to Come. Could you tell our listeners the meaning behind that?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for asking. So The Wrath to Come as a phrase originates in the Bible. The reason that I use it here is because it comes from a James Baldwin quotation. Of course, James Baldwin, the great African-American writer in the second half of the 20th century. And he has a line that just kind of resonated for me the whole time that I was writing this book, and in many ways was the raison d'etre behind the book. It was my kind of impetus into writing it. So what Baldwin said was, "It is terrible to watch people cling to their captivity and insist on their own destruction. I think Black people have always felt this about America and Americans, and have always seen spinning above the thoughtless American head the shape of the wrath to come." So it's an image of racial reckoning and this idea of thoughtless white Americans who just don't get it. And so I wanted to write this book in an effort to try to educate myself better and hopefully, share that learning with others about what it is that we don't get about our own thoughtlessness, our thoughtlessness about history. And this idea of this reckoning, the reckoning may be at hand. If it's not, it's certainly coming. And but I particularly liked the phrase as a title because of the ways that it also then resonates with not only The Grapes of Wrath, obviously the classic Steinbeck novel, which was published at exactly the same time. So it was published in 1939 as the film was about to be produced. And then it was instantly filmed in 1940. And so basically the film version of Gone with the Wind and the film version of Grapes of Wrath were in kind of cinemas at the same time. So they're very much, so there are lots of connections between them. And I talk about this in the book, but of course Steinbeck got his title, The Grapes of Wrath, from Julia Ward Howe's Civil War anthem, which is a call to abolition, which is "Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord, the battle hymn of the Republic." So that's the great anthem of the North, which is anti-slavery, pro-abolition. And of course, it has the famous line, "He hath trampled out the vintage where the grapes of wrath are stored." And obviously, again, a biblical image, right? So what I really liked about The Wrath to Come was the way that it connected the Civil War, abolition, the Grapes of Wrath, the American Dream, Gone with the Wind, Baldwin, and this kind of these gaps in white America's understanding of our own history and the ways in which we might try to be less thoughtless about the wrath to come. So it seemed to me that it kind of summed up everything I was trying to do. And I very much wanted to give Baldwin, well, he's a very important voice in the book, as are several other great African-American writers who I use as kind of touchstones. So there's a couple of key points from Ralph Ellison, a couple of key points from Toni Morrison. And I wanted to make sure that some of the great Black, and Du Bois, of course, the great historian, that their voices were carrying some of the key moments and some of the key insights, because I'm definitely learning from them and they needed to be front and center.
You are listening to Professor Sarah Churchwell. Her book, The Wrath to Come, Gone with the Wind and the Lies America Tells, is out now, published by Apollo.
Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt.